it's important that we keep on schedule. We have not only people on the program who have other engagements who have to get off on schedule, but because of our televising that's going on upstairs, we have to keep this thing rolling. So try to get back from your breaks promptly as you can. There have been some changes in the schedule. I think you've got notice we have, instead of the Roots of Conflict panel with Stephen Young and Stephen Morris that was scheduled at this time, is being moved up to 11 o'clock to accommodate Senator Sims, who will be our next speaker. The Senator Sims, a Republican from Idaho, is a man to whom I think all of us probably in this room feel an enormous debt, because he was the man who retired Frank Church in 1980. He was an apple farmer out in Caldwell, Idaho. He decided to get in politics. He ran for the House in 1972 and won. He served in the House from 72 to 1981. And then he took on the task of knocking over a man who I think they say no, speak no ill of the dead, and Frank Church is now gone. But I think that there is no exaggeration to say that Frank Church was one man who probably did more to undermine our intelligence agencies in this country than any other single being, including those who would like to have done that from Moscow and other foreign capitals. He is a member of the Finance, Budget, Environment, and Public Works and Joint Economic Committees. He chairs two subcommittees. And as a former Marine myself, I'm very proud to welcome here today another former Marine who served in the Corps for 3 years, Senator Steve Sims of Idaho. Senator.
Thank you very much, Reed. I think that we all owe you a debt of gratitude for the important task that you carry out with accuracy in the media for all Americans, and I think for all free people in the world. It is so critical that we try to record history as it really happened, and if on a day-to-day basis, as well as what happened during the Vietnam era. I would also like to pay thanks to Dr. Bruce Loeb, who has helped me with some of the research that I'm going to present here this morning to this group. And I thank him for that, and I thank him also for much of the help that he gave me in that great crusade in Idaho in 1980, because it was a big task, and we were very happy to be successful. And I think that the American people really spoke very soundly in 1980 across this nation that they wanted strong leadership in the administration and a stronger position to really bring peace through strength, as Red McDaniel so properly put it in his remarks just moments ago. Now, I am not the kind of speaker that normally reads a text or reads a speech, but I do think what I'm going to say this morning is important enough that I want to be sure that I say it as accurately as possible, so I will be using my notes. And for those of you who know me will probably wonder why I'm trying to read a speech, but because I'm not necessarily a good reader, so I'll say that in advance. As Reed told you, I'm an apple farmer by profession, and we Marines never did claim to have any bounds on intellectualism, Reed. We just said we had a few good men. I was not in the Vietnam conflict, I might say, at the beginning. My conflict was the first time we lost the Vietnam War was in 1962, when President Kennedy failed to liberate those good people in the island of Cuba and allowed the Kennedy-Khrushchev agreements to be violated in the first outset. And that certainly woke me up as a young lieutenant in the Marine Corps that maybe all was not well in Washington, and that's really what got me first started into politics. I was about as apolitical. I was a football player in college and majored in horticulture. And my brother majored in political science, and he runs a fruit ranch back home now. And, so I was really not even in, I never dreamed I would be in politics, but much less I never dreamed I'd be a United States Senator. But after the fiasco during the Bay of Pigs and then following on with the missile crisis in 1962, which I was fortunate enough to have participated in, the missile crisis, and with going from the West Coast around through the Panama Canal and to the Caribbean, and watched the politicians in Washington just give the store away to the Soviets. Well, I went back to the farm and started paying attention to what was going on, and I think that's how it ended up that I'm here today, because I always felt that if we would not confront the enemy right here in our backyard, how were we going to ever sustain confronting the enemy several thousand miles away from Washington, D.C.? And that question, I think, is one we still must ask ourselves, and when we relate what we're here to try to put together now, which I think is most important, that what happened in Vietnam be recorded accurately. And I don't believe that the public broadcast PBS series, Vietnam, A Television History, is accurate of what really happened. And we do not want to allow that to go down in the history books and in the school libraries as the end-all answer that's a teaching tool to teach the young people of the future what happened in Southeast Asia, because it would be tragic if it was. So what I'm going to tell you is that we really didn't lose the war in South Vietnam. If you study history, we won the war on several occasions, but it was clearly won by 1972 and clearly given away later on. That's really what I'm going to tell you this morning, is that we won the war and then we gave it away. Now, the narrator of the PBS series Vietnam, A Television History, in explaining the end of the Vietnam War, declares, and I quote, that the Americans counted nearly 60,000 dead and more than 300,000 wounded, and it was America's first defeat. But what the PBS series on Vietnam does not reveal, the real reason for that first defeat. For 13 hours, the program cleverly and persuasively urges viewers to believe that North Vietnam's victory was inevitable, and that America's and South Vietnam's defeat was predestined. Phan Van Dong, North Vietnam's premier, explains in the sixth episode of the series, and I quote Mr. Dong, "Throughout Vietnam's history, sacrifice and complete victory have always been the case. It was so in the past, it will be so in the future. This is something we can be sure of," end of quote. The PBS documentary consistently implies that North Vietnam won the war because her cause was noble. Explains the narrator, and I quote, "The country was mobilized with Ho Chi Minh's slogan, 'Nothing is more precious than independence and freedom,'" end of quote. Think about what he's saying. Think about their definition of what independence and freedom is, and wonder why it is that people get in leaky boats today and try to escape that slave camp and hellhole now that once used to be a beautiful country where people could, in fact, have opportunities that are no longer there for the people. It's tragic. But North Vietnam's victory was not preordained. The reason for America's loss in Vietnam is found in that it was not found in the nobility of the communist cause. And why did the Americans suffer their first defeat in Vietnam? That's a question we all have to ask. We certainly didn't lose the war on the battlefield. You're going to hear from H.G. Summers, a very distinguished United States Army colonel who was one of our most decorated soldiers in the Korean War and the Vietnam War. But Colonel Summers recalls a conversation with Colonel Tu of the North Vietnamese Army in Hanoi in 1975. And I quote, "Colonel Summers, you know you never defeated us on the battlefield." Colonel Tu, "That may be so, but it's also irrelevant." Colonel Tu is correct, because the final deciding, deciding the outcome of the Vietnam War, America's unbroken battlefield victories became irrelevant. Colin Gray, the former assistant director of the prestigious International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, fixes the real reason on the loss in Vietnam by explaining the following. And he says, "For good reasons, most Americans appear convinced that their country lost the war in Vietnam. That is not quite true. The facts are that the United States and the Republic of Vietnam had effectively won the war by mid or late 1972, and then, in America's case at least, proceeded to discard that victory." John Colvin, the Consul General of the British Mission in Hanoi during the war, agrees with Gray, declaring, "Victory in American hands was not so much as thrown away as it was shunned. And how did America discard and shun the victory in Vietnam?" Well, as a member of Congress during the last 2 or 3 years of the Vietnam War, it's very difficult and unpleasant memory for me to think about what the blunt truth was and to tell what the blunt truth was. America lost the war in Vietnam on the floor of the Senate and the House of Representatives. The Congress of the United States legislated defeat in Vietnam. To prove my point, I must remind you of the events in Vietnam in 1972, when Colin Gray believes America had effectively won the war before we discarded the victory. On March 31, North Vietnam's Defense Minister, General Giap, called on the Vietnam People's Armed Forces to march forward to complete the victory. The Communists hurled 14 divisions spearheaded by 600 Russian tanks across the 17th parallel, which was the biggest attack thus far in the war. The Easter offense was South Vietnam's moment of truth. President Tu told his countrymen, "This is the final battle to decide the survival of our people." Unlike the Tet Offensive 4 years earlier, the U.S. military support was now very limited. There were only about 60,000 Americans were still in Vietnam at the time, and the main U.S. support came from the air. President Nixon unleashed tremendous tactical and strategic airstrikes to help crush the communist offensive. And let me digress for a moment to illustrate the anti-American theme of that PBS series describing the 1972 bombing. The narrator explains, and I quote, "Along with conventional bombing, the bombing planes dropped napalm." As the narrator speaks, a picture is shown on the screen of a heart-rending scene of a little Vietnamese girl named Kim running down the street naked after presumably being hit by napalm dropped from an American plane. That's the presumption that you're left with when you watch the program. What the narrator did not explain was that the bomb which struck Kim and several South Vietnamese soldiers was accidentally dropped from a South Vietnamese sky raider. According to Stephen Morris of the Wall Street Journal, the scene illustrated not American bestiality, but a horrible South Vietnamese accident. Nevertheless, it was upon such evidence that the radical anti-American case in the PBS series rested with no response. Along with massive airstrikes, President Nixon ordered the mining of North Vietnam's ports, a bold move which had not been done before and which was long overdue. In fact, I was interested to see recently that President Nixon says that one of the biggest mistakes of his, when he looks back at his presidency, was that he waited until 72 to mine the harbors, that he should have done so in January 20th, 1969. 75% of North Vietnam's imports from Russia and Eastern Europe entered from the sea, 95% at Haiphong. Almost all of North Vietnam's gasoline, diesel fuel, ammunition, weapons reached North Vietnam from the sea. Predictably, the president's firm action was denounced by a storm of criticism in the liberal media and by the hand-wringers in the Congress. Senate Democrats voted to condemn Nixon's decision to mine Haiphong. Senator Hartke cried hysterically, and I quote, "We must act at once to reverse this fateful error. Armageddon may be only hours away," end of quote. But the American people overwhelmingly backed the president. A Singlinger poll showed that 76% of the American people supported President Nixon's initiatives in Vietnam. A Harris survey found that 55% supported the bombing of North Vietnam, 64% supported the mining of Haiphong, and 74% thought it important that South Vietnam not fall into the hands of the communists. The U.S. bombing and mining were vital, but if the communist drive was to be stopped, the ARVN forces had to stop it on the ground. As General Westmoreland explained, and I quote, "Here apparently was the ultimate test of the long years of the American effort to create a viable South Vietnamese armed force. Even as the test developed, the last American battalions began to move, not to help in the fight, but to complete the American withdrawal. As the results eventually demonstrated, the ARVN, for all of its many errors in plans and execution, no longer required the assistance of the American ground troops." I think that's a very significant point. In describing the Arvin's combat record and the Easter Offensive, the PBS series reveals its blatant anti-South Vietnamese bias. The narrator contends that the South Vietnamese army was in disarray and fleeing from the communist troops. In his review of the PBS series, Stephen Morris writes in the Wall Street Journal that in the documentary South Vietnam's soldiers are portrayed as frightened and mostly unwilling to fight. President Nixon disagreed. U.S. mining of the Haiphong Harbor and the use of our air power against targets in North Vietnam helped save the day, but the fighting on the ground was done exclusively by South Vietnamese forces. The South Vietnamese demonstrated in 1972 that they could effectively stop an invasion on the ground if they were adequately armed and provided with air support. By September, North Vietnam's forces had retreated. A captured communist document conceded that we failed to accomplish our spring-summer plan. Our objectives have not been achieved. 400 of the 600 tanks had been knocked out. Close to 100,000 communist regular troops had been killed. Finally, after 10 years of fighting, a successful formula had been found to deny South Vietnam to the communists. Severely tested by the Easter Offensive, this formula required several segments for success. Number one, American military advisors were still needed to aid the Arvin troops. Number two, American air support was required to destroy enemy positions and to discourage future invasions. Number three, mining Haiphong would discourage communist offenses by preventing a sustained military attack to the south. And number four, and most importantly, the Arvin's ground troops could challenge North Vietnam's best units. American combat troops were no longer needed for the defense of South Vietnam. Under these promising conditions, Congress proceeded to legislate defeat in Vietnam. First, by preventing any future U.S. military action in Indochina, and later, in the final coup de grace, in 1975, by denying South Vietnam and Cambodia the military aid necessary for their own self-defense. After numerous unsuccessful efforts, Congress finally pushed through the Case Church Amendment on June 29, 1973, preventing U.S. military involvement in Southeast Asia. The terms of the Case Church were categorical, and I quote the language of the legislation: notwithstanding any provision of law on or after August 15, 1973, no funds herein or heretofore appropriated may be obligated or expended to finance directly or indirectly combat activities by the United States military forces in or over or from off the shores of North Vietnam, South Vietnam, Laos, or Cambodia. President Nixon had vetoed previous bills to cut off all American military action in Indochina, and he denounced the Case Church vigorously, but the bill was veto-proof. It passed 278-124, which is veto-proof, 69% in the House, and 64-26, 71% in the Senate. Not satisfied with preventing any future military support of our allies, Congress proceeded to deny South Vietnam and Cambodia the basic weapons supplies needed for their defense. In 1972-73, U.S. military aid to South Vietnam was $2.1 billion. In 1973-74, aid to South Vietnam was cut to $964 million, more than half. Less than half was given just 1 year later. 74-75, the year of the final offensive, military aid totaled only $700 million. Now, such drastic cuts in military supplies crippled the Arvin forces so that helicopter missions were dropped from 16,000 a month to 3,000 a month because of a shortage of spare parts and gasoline. In the final battle in 1975, the Arvin desperately lacked all types of weapons and equipment. At that point, I had the opportunity to take a trip to Southeast Asia, and I visited Saigon City, up into the Tu Khor area, and the Trang, and up above towards the Central Highlands. And I was on a solo trip, so I had the opportunity. I had the very in-country help of a State Department officer by the name of Jay Blowers, who had spent about 6 or 7 years in country. There may be some of you here that know him. He actually was in charge of the operation to remove the reactors out of the atomic-powered reactor in South Vietnam before the final collapse. But he took me around the country. I went up and visited the 22nd Division, talked to many of the troops. They appeared to be very well-trained. They had high morale. There was one problem. They were very concerned at that time, the troops that I talked with, the officers and the troops both, about whether or not American aid was going to continue. It was like a psychological pall hanging over the morale of these soldiers who were being asked to go into combat, had been trained by Americans on the art of heavy firepower, and as the old saying used to be, peace through fire superiority. They had been trained to use high firepower, many hand grenades when necessary, and certainly all of a sudden when they are told by their troop platoon leaders and company grade officers and battalion commanders, sorry fellows, we're going to have to cut back on the amount of ammunition you can take, we're short on supplies. Then when I was in country, it was in February, I believe it's February of 1975, I was following a trip of a group of congressmen that had been there about the 2 weeks before, and one of those congresspersons was Bella Abzug, who was quoted all over the press as saying that the aid would be stopped. And these soldiers were seeing this in the free press in South Vietnam, that American Congress was about to cut off all aid. Well, you can imagine, those of you here, what it's like to be a platoon leader or a company commander or a battalion commander of a bunch of troops who think that they're going to run out of ammunition and they'll have to stop fighting by June at the latest. This was a very difficult situation. Now, the Tram Van Lam, South Vietnam's foreign minister, came to Washington about that time to plead for $300 million supplemental appropriation. Some congressman told him that the Arvin wasn't fighting effectively, and Tram Van Lam replied. He said, "We fought well in 68 and 72, and these are the same soldiers. They held An Loc for years. The North Vietnamese have 10 times more shells than we have. If our troops have 10 bullets, they know they will get 10 more when they need them, then they will fight. But inevitably, when soldiers have no bullets, no equipment, no means of transportation, it is only natural that the morale will suffer." I know Congressman John, I'm having a mental block right now, I think of his name. He's a Marine who served in Vietnam. He's from Pennsylvania, a Democrat. And I... Murtha. Congressman John Murtha and I pled with our colleagues at the Congress at that time for that $300 million of aid because we could see it of what was happening to the morale of the troops. Congressman Murtha was certainly more of an expert than I was, having been a Vietnam veteran himself, in seeing what was happening, and he felt very strongly that we must get that aid over there, and what we needed to do was appropriate enough money to show that it would be there for several years running, not to go 3 months at a time, because that even put the troop leaders and the commanders in the field at a disadvantage just because of the psychology of it. If one side is telling them you're going to have unlimited supplies from the Soviets, the other side is telling them we were going to give you enough for 3 more months at a time, even that put them at a disadvantage. But at the time, the Congress was cutting South Vietnam's military aid. Soviet supplies to North Vietnam quadrupled. Communist supplies were so abundant in the North and vast storehouses were left unhidden to move men and equipment rapidly to the South. Portions of the Ho Chi Minh Trail were paved with limestone and packed with dirt. Obviously, the Communists had no reason to fear U.S. airstrikes. I was absolutely appalled when our intelligence people gave me a briefing at the headquarters in Saigon up at Tonsonut Airport, and showed photographs of trucks coming two and three abreast down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, trucks that probably had been built with American technology, incidentally, that were hauling the supplies and equipment to support the war effort against South Vietnam, open and exposed blatantly in the daylight, with no fear whatsoever of any American air power retaliation. So in the spring of 1975, Congress also denied military aid to Cambodia, where Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge was locked in a fierce combat with the government troops. English journalist William Shawcross, a severe critic of the U.S. policy in Cambodia, revealed that in those final 3 months, each side fought with extraordinary bravery and each suffered losses that would have been intolerable for most armies. According to Shawcross, ammunition decided the outcome of the war. Within days of the start of the offensive, Hanoi was no longer withholding arms. The Khmer Rouge had far more weapons and ammunition than ever before, but the government troops depended on Congress for aid, and by April 11th, no more funds were available to the desperate Cambodian army. Now, I left Tonsonut Air Base in a Air America helicopter and flew up the across the Delta and up the Mekong River to Phnom Penh on my way back to the States. Spent a very memorable day there under the guide of Major Ken Hollander, who I believe is here at the Pentagon now as a lieutenant colonel, a fine young American Army officer who took me out to a battalion CP, took me to some of the aid stations, and I can say that what I witnessed there were very disciplined, young, but very disciplined Cambodian soldiers who were fighting with great deal of bravery and great discipline. And it was heartbreaking to think that only months later that these people would be part of one of the biggest genocides in the history of this country. And I remember those Cambodian people that were making the, out of the, what do they call it, the tin Cambodian silver that they used, old shell cases and so forth, and made little elephants and different kinds of trinkets, the great skilled artisans, wonderful people. Our aid was getting to them at the time, and I saw the aid coming in, I saw the evidence people were getting it, but the town was surrounded in a very small perimeter. It was certainly a wartime situation and a desperate situation, and it was unbelievable to me that Congress could cut those people off at that time and leave them there for the wolves, so to speak. Now, President Ford at the time made a very strong statement, and he said it will be an unbelievable horror story if the Khmer Rouge win. The American ambassador, John Gunther Dean, told Congress that the communists would impose a brutal revolution if they controlled Cambodia. He told me that in the day that I visited with him, and he told me that he said, I've been through World War II, the Korean War, and the problems in Vietnam, and he was a soldier in World War II, so he said, I'm not afraid myself, but he said, someday you'll probably see my picture out here as the last American to leave, taking that flag down on that flagpole that he pointed out the door to me. How well I remembered that, and how sick I was when the fateful day finally came that Cambodia had collapsed. And just as Ambassador Dean had told me would happen, there he was out there, the last American to leave, taking down our flag, leaving those people to a slaughter that no one could have imagined would have been that bad, although some people had warned the Congress and other members of the Congress how bad it would be. But it was even worse, I think, than Ambassador Dean and President Ford and others had thought that it might be. The Senate doves rejected Cambodia's plea. They knew better. Senator Ted Kennedy dismissed predictions of a large-scale communist atrocities as political rhetoric, that was his words, and scare tactics about Indochina. Sounds exactly like what they say on the floor of the Senate today about Central America. Senator Mike Mansfield reasoned, it's up to those people to settle their differences themselves in their own way, and that includes Cambodia. Incredibly, after they voted against the military aid, Senators Church and McGovern minimized the likelihood of widespread communist atrocities. According to the New York Times, Church and McGovern cited statements by Prince Norodom Sihanouk, the exiled Cambodian leader, that the lives of President Lon Nol and his immediate entourage would be in any jeopardy when the communists took over. On April 17th, Cambodia surrendered to Pol Pot, preparing the way for one of the most barbaric acts in human history, the genocide of the Cambodian people, where 2 out of every 7 Cambodians were murdered. The school teachers, the preachers, the doctors, the business people, the farmers, the artisans, anybody who had anything to do with the productive side of the society or the infrastructure were massacred. Predictably, the Case Church Amendment and the cuts in the military aid encouraged North Vietnam to invade South Vietnam. In 1975, Graham Martin, the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam, revealed that the Soviet Union told North Vietnam to go for broke because support for honoring the American commitment to South Vietnam had been irretrievably eroded in the Congress. General Van Tien Dung, chief of staff of the North Vietnamese Army and commander of the final offensive, in his book, Our Great Spring Victory, written in 1977, describes how the North Vietnamese leaders raised heatedly discussed whether or not they should move back into South Vietnam again and try another offensive like they'd tried in 1972. And they were concerned that if they started large-scale battles and the Americans re-entered it, that they'd have the same failure they'd had in 1972. But those people in North Vietnam who said that the United States would not enter, they finally were right that we wouldn't, and then that they would be successful. According to General Dung, the North Vietnamese Politburo concluded, and I quote, "The United States was meeting difficulties at home and abroad, and its ability to give political or military aid was declining every day. Not only had the United States decreased its aid to Saigon, it also faced increasing opposition to any effort to jump back into the South. General Dung decided that South Vietnam would be forced to fight a poor man's war." Now, it turned out that he was right. The Case Church Amendment had and the cuts in military aid assured the communist victory in 1975. As General Westmoreland explained, "We were paralyzed by the Case Church Amendment, which prohibited the use of funds for Southeast Asia combat activities. That action by Congress not only tied the hands of President Ford, but also removed our only deterrent to large-scale attack. It's too bad we couldn't again mine the Haiphong Harbor, and that the President did not have the authority to use tactical air and B-52 strikes to hit the communist supply lines." That quote certainly rings a personal note to me. When I left Phnom Penh by C-130, hitched a ride with a C-130 and flew back up to Udorn late that night, and a U.S. Army colonel of long experience in the Strategic Bomber Command took me for a tour of our air base at Udorn, where we still had 23 B-52s. There were 2 miles of bombs stacked along the sides of the runway in bomb revetments, which were starting to rust at the fins, and he was showing it to me, and he said, "Son," he said, "these bombs were made to be dropped, and there are lucrative targets within an hour's flight of where we are right now." And he said, "They're rusting out, and they've already paid for." And he said, "It's absolutely tragic that you won't allow the Congress and the administration, who is bound by the Congress's laws, will not allow us to interdict what's happening in this battle right now." He said, "There's never been so much blatant openness of the movements of the enemy troops, the stacking of supplies, the targets are so lucrative." He said he just couldn't imagine it. I always wondered what happened to those bombs. I don't know whether we hauled them out of there or whether we left them there like we did the gold in the bank at Saigon. But unfortunately, I mentioned that at that time, and I've never been able to find out why that gold was left in Saigon until I read General Westmoreland's book, and he makes an explanation of it. But I thought that it was very interesting that with 2 aircraft, we could have hauled out 16 tons of gold, and at least it could have financed a government in exile, and it could have financed maybe Vietnamese patriots who wanted to go in and start a war of liberation of their own to free those people. But unfortunately, the United States did not carry out its commitment, as President Ford watched helplessly, and I'm quoting President Ford now. And he said, "Unfortunately, the United States did not carry out its commitment to supplying the military hardware and economic aid to South Vietnam. If we had carried out those commitments we had made, the tragic sacrifices that were made by so many would not have been in vain." So what happened, ladies and gentlemen, after enduring 360,000 casualties and spending more than $140 billion, the United States Congress left the field of the communists. Senator Fong of Hawaii told his Senate colleagues the hard truth, and I quote Senator Fong, "There is no question but what we have betrayed the Cambodians and we have betrayed the South Vietnamese. In my mind, there is no question that we have reneged on our commitments and we have not lived up to our commitments." Senator Fong was right when he said that. The American people and the Vietnam veterans agree with Senator Fong. In 1980, the polling firm of Lew Harris and Associates conducted a lengthy, in-depth study of the attitudes of the public and the veterans about the Vietnam War. Harris asked for a reaction to this statement, and here's the statement, the question. "The trouble in Vietnam was that our troops were asked to fight a war which our political leaders in Washington would not let them win." That was the question, statement. 73% of the people said that's true. 92% of the Vietnam veterans agreed with that statement. And the consequences of the communist victory to the people of Indochina are too well known. The area has become an Asian Auschwitz. George McGovern said the genocide in Cambodia made Germany's operation look tame by comparison in terms of a percentage of a population. That's true. Alexander Solzhenitsyn indicts American doves for their role in the communist victory in this scathing language. Solzhenitsyn told the Harvard graduating class in 1978, and I quote, he said, members of the U.S. anti-war movement wound up being involved in a betrayal of Far Eastern nations, in a genocide and in a suffering today of 30 million people there. Do these convinced pacifists hear the moans coming from there? Do they understand their responsibility today, or do they prefer not to hear? The dread consequences of America's defeat in Vietnam are not limited to the suffering millions in Indochina. Today, the so-called Vietnam Syndrome influences U.S. policy in Central America. A popular bumper sticker that I'm sure all of you have seen at some place in this country, I've seen them all over the country, states, El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam. Senator Gary Hart compares U.S. policy in Central America to Vietnam, declaring that Central America, we must not fail to, quote, learn the lessons of Vietnam. The explanation I have given for America's first defeat is not found in the PBS series because it does not conform to the thesis that American involvement was immoral and illegal from the beginning. That's the thesis of the 13-part series, and that's wrong. And that under Ho Chi Minh's so-called enlightened leadership, a communist victory was inevitable and the South Vietnam was a brutal and corrupt nation not deserving of American aid. That's the impression they try to leave to the people. Same parallel as today, that somehow the United States is supporting an unpopular, brutal government in El Salvador and that we're trying to interfere with or overthrow or interdict a popular government in Nicaragua, when just the opposite is what the truth is. Now, if we Americans are ever to understand the Vietnam War, we must reject the thesis of this documentary, Vietnam, A Television History. The Vietnam War, as General Omar Bradley put it in 1967, he said, and I quote General Bradley, a right war at the right place, at the right time, with the right enemy. End of quote. I might just paraphrase and say, and the only thing wrong with it was the outcome. And that's what we're here to talk about. Vietnam was, in President Reagan's words, a noble cause, but it was a cause lost by error, by indecision, and by timidity. The courage of the Congress did not match that of the soldiers, of the people, and the troops that we had in the battlefield. Tragically, North Vietnam's leaders were proven right when they predicted in 1968 that we will defeat the enemy on the political front right in the United States. If we are to learn the real lessons of Vietnam, America must never again forget what General MacArthur's fundamental axiom was. And I quote General MacArthur, war's very object is victory, not prolonged indecision. America must follow President Reagan's common sense warning to never again ask men to fight and die for their country unless we intend to win what our objectives are. Finally, if the United States is to remain a great nation, we only need to look back at history and remember what Winston Churchill said, the price of greatness is responsibility. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we do have a responsibility as Americans to support what Reed Irvine is trying to do to get this story told in a positive television documentary that can tell the true history of what happened so we don't make the same mistake right here in our own backyard in Central America for many, many reasons, for moral obligation that I think we have. There is a moral obligation for we Americans to support our friends and oppose our enemies. And if we will do that, we will restore our credibility with our allies. And we will also restore the respect of our adversaries. And that, in itself, will be the first step towards lasting peace for the remaining part of this century. Thank you very much.
Senator Sims has got to go up and do his television interview. We are running a little bit over, so we want to thank him very much for an excellent presentation and move on to Morrison Young, who will be up next. Which one of us wants to go first?
Steve wants 5 minutes on the PBS program.
Okay. I said just 5 minutes?
And then,
no,
I'll go and he'll come back.
I just want to spend 5 minutes talking about the series and the background. And then he'll speak for, say, 15 minutes on this.
Yeah.
And then I'll speak for 15
minutes. I see. Okay, fine.
If you couldn't get the screen raised, then they have trouble seeing it. As tall as they can stand up if they want to.
Jesus Christ.
Okay, I have a couple of announcements here. There's a phone message for Dr. Cashel at the registration desk. If Dr. Cashel is here, we'll take that call. The luncheon, which will follow this session, will be held in the Capitol Room on the lobby level. Take a left when you get off the elevator, and you'll see the sign. Okay, now the next program was the one that was supposed to take place at 10:30. The Roots of Conflict. To save time, I'm just going to introduce the speakers as Stephen Morris with the Institute of East Asian Studies at the University of California. And he came to my attention first with an excellent article, a critique of the PBS series that was published in the Wall Street Journal. And Stephen Young, Dean of Hamline Law School of St. Paul, Minnesota, who received his law degree from Harvard and served as an assistant dean there from 78 to 80. He was in Vietnam in the Village Development Program, and he has been an assistant to the Minister for Economic Affairs at the Embassy in Saigon. He's the author of two books and numerous articles on Vietnam. Now, the Steve Morris wants to speak very briefly for 5 minutes. I got that right. About the, we got two Stevens. I want to make sure I'm not. He wants to speak very briefly for 5 minutes about some of the aspects of the program itself. Then we will hear from Stephen Young, who will speak for about 15 minutes on the critique of the roots of the conflict. And then Steve Morris will come back again and speak also on that subject. So first of all, Stephen Morris.
Thank you. I just want to speak in an introductory and brief way about some things I've learned about the series since I wrote my piece for the Wall Street Journal. There was one mistake in my article, which I'm proud to confess. I attributed all the inaccuracies in the first two series to a French production team, and the French production team were responsible for all the film research. However, Judith Vecchione, in an angry telephone conversation with me, wanted to make clear to me that she actually wrote the script for the first two series, and she was responsible for all the factual inaccuracies in the first two series. And so I want to get the record straight right now. I should point out, however, that the French and the British and the Americans co-produced this series, and they had the right to re-edit the program in any way they wanted to tailor to their local audience. And for example, the last episode was not shown in Britain. That the French ran the series as three episodes instead of 13, emphasizing the French experience. I should point out that some former members of the French armed forces demonstrated outside the television studios in Paris against the presentation that was there in France to indicate that the resentment is not only confined to the United States about the series. I should point out to you that this program was not any central organized conspiracy. It was a centrally disorganized shambles. There were several different producers. There were six different production teams in this country. There was a French production team. There was a British production team. And in general, I feel that the Americans who were involved were not as ideologically intense and fanatical as the British, for example. And there were some good works done by the British, and I particularly, by the Americans, I should say, and I'd particularly like to refer to Austin Hoyt, who I think, had he been involved in the making of the entire series, would have left a very important and creditable legacy in the history of the Vietnam War. But that was not the case. I should point out to you also that Stanley Karnow had very little to do with the television series. His book, the interpretation of which I disagree with, is basically an honest, factually honest account of the history of the Vietnam War. There are some omissions there. But although I disagree with him on his general overview and interpretation, one cannot attribute dishonesty to him. However, one can attribute something close to that to some of the other people involved in the television series.